TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges interviews Matt Taibbi on Hamilton 68. Hamilton 68 was a Twitter-based dashboard designed to be used by reporters and academics to, quote, measure Russian disinformation. Chris Hedges wrote, "The panic over Russian disinformation that followed the election of Donald Trump often relied on a source now known to have been fraudulent." Hamilton 68. Here's Hedges' February 10, 2023 interview of Matt Taibbi on the Real News Network. Taibbi is one of the reporters who was given access to the Twitter archives by the new owner, Elon Musk. Matt Taibbi is an author, journalist, and podcaster, and former contributing editor for Rolling Stone. He's publisher of the newsletter Racket on Substack. Chris Hedges is a journalist, Presbyterian minister, author, and commentator. He worked as war correspondent and reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005. Chris Hedges summarizes what Taibbi found.
Matt Taibbi has published an investigation, which you can read on his Substack, about a vast propaganda campaign called Hamilton 68, launched a year after Donald Trump won the presidency. It smeared critics of the Democratic Party from the left and the right as Russian assets. Hamilton 68 claimed it used a complex data analysis and relied on so-called disinformation experts to ferret out fake news on social media that emanated from the Kremlin. Hamilton 68, a computerized dashboard designed to be used by reporters and academics to quote-unquote measure Russian disinformation, was run by Democratic operatives, including John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, and figures from the intelligence agencies such as the CIA, the FBI, and Homeland Security, as well as neoconservatives and establishment Republicans such as Bill Kristol, who do not support Trump and have been warmly embraced by the Democratic Party. Mainstream news outlets, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, PBS, NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, as well as Mother Jones, which ran 14 stories based on the group's alleged research, cited Hamilton 68 as an authoritative source, even as the site refused to disclose the data or methods it used to make its assessments. Hundreds, if not thousands, of media headlines were flagged as Russian bot infiltrations in online discussions about Brett Kavanaugh, Tulsi Gabbard's campaign, the Parkland shooting, U.S. missile strikes in Syria, and Bernie Sanders' campaign, many other stories. Fact-checking sites such as PolitiFact and Snopes also relied on Hamilton 68. Taibbi, given access to Twitter's internal memos and emails by Elon Musk, who bought Twitter, was able to expose not only the fraudulent claims of Hamilton 68, but the massive failure of the press, which was a full partner in one of the worst forms of censorship since the red baiting of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, one that targeted people with dissident or unconventional opinions and accused them, in essence, of un-American activities. So let's go back, just set the stage. Right after the defeat of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party's response, just to remind viewers of the loss and how that response led to the rise of so-called disinformation experts and groups like Hamilton 68.
It's a complicated story. I think the backdrop to the Hamilton 68 story is, if you really want to look at the full timeline, the Columbia Journalism Review has a whole 26,000 word piece this week. The shortcut version of this story is that after Trump won the election, there was immediately a series of stories coming from different directions saying that the election was illegitimate, that Trump had been assisted by Russians, that there was some kind of collusion going on, and that there was disinformation in the news media that had been amplified by Russian accounts, that Trump's own accounts and hashtags and tweets had been amplified by Russian forces. And then formally, August of 2017, this group Hamilton 68 came out It's an outgrowth of both the German Marshall Fund and a think tank called the Alliance for Securing Democracy. And it was basically a tool designed to be used by reporters and academics that, quote unquote, tracked Russian disinformation by monitoring accounts that were called linked, quote, linked to Russian influence activities online. Now, they never disclosed what was on this list or what they were actually tracking. And it was only by accident, looking through some Twitter files, emails, that we find this big conversation where internally Twitter is saying, we've got the list, we've reverse engineered it, and they're not Russians. These were mostly ordinary people. Out of 644 accounts, only 36 of them began in Russia. And most of the rest, from what I found, were ordinary people, a lot of them right-leaning, but some of them on the left too. So it was a fraud. It was a big, gigantic media fraud, basically equal parts disinformation on the part of this think tank, but also, as you alluded to, the enormous media failure, which would be, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Of those 36, weren't a lot of them from your story, RT was Russia Today, was the Russian television station.
There were several RT-related accounts. There were some Sputnik accounts. There were some Russian embassy accounts. There was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of these were sort of official Russian accounts. Now, Hamilton eventually transitioned to a more open system that was only tracking Russian official accounts, which is interesting in itself. But that's actually more of a real service. But what they did is they piled all these real accounts that had real opinions that maybe a channel like RT or the Russian Foreign Ministry, they might have an interest that coincided, but these were real people in America and Canada and Great Britain who had these opinions. They either favored Trump or were retweeting hashtags like walk away or fire McMaster. And this group just described that as part of a sort of Russian influence campaign when in fact it was not that.
Just give us, before we go in, you actually reached out to these people, some of these people, I'll let you explain that. But just give us a sense of the scale, because it was massive. It just dominated the press. I mean, we were talking before we went on the air. I think one of the reasons the media organizations are going to ignore it is because what are they going to say? We're sorry for the last 4 years. It's such an egregious failure to admit what they did. It ends up looking like an article from The Onion.
Yeah, this would be a difficult thing to retract in a way. I wanted to hear what the innocent explanation was, not only from this group, but from all the media companies that ran these stories. So I not only sent queries up, but I kind of threw a fit about it publicly on Twitter and online, you know, sort of daring them or taunting them in an effort to try to get comment out. There was some reason that I wasn't privy to. I really wanted to hear it. And they no commented to me until the story made a big splash on the internet, at which point some of them started to come in. Now, the media people haven't commented yet, but there's no excuse for what happened with them because, you know, you and I both been reporters, Chris. If someone comes to me with a story and says, we're tracking Russian, we have a magic box that tracks Russian influence, and they are connected to all these organic political activities. You think about things like hashtag walk away, that's Democrats who are leaving the party. Hashtag fire McMaster, that's Republicans who are against H.R. McMaster, right? Hashtag release the memo, that's Republicans who want Devin Nunes' memo out. All these things were quote unquote linked to Russian influence on all the biggest channels and newspapers in America, and that the source was wrong. I mean, again, what would you do as a reporter? Because I'd say, what's in the box, right? Tell me how it works. And they never asked that question.
Well, I love this. This is from your article. It's Laura Rosenberg, the two founders of Hamilton 68, the blue and red team of former counselor to Marco Rubio, Jamie Fly, and Hillary for America foreign policy advisor Laura Rosenberger, told Politico they couldn't reveal the names of the accounts because the Russians will simply shut them down. It's kind of like Joe McCarthy's empty briefcase.
Yeah, that's what they were doing. They were saying inside this thing, there are subversives who are linked to Russia, but they weren't that. Like I looked in the list. Chronology here is a little complicated. Twitter was upset about all this stuff. And so they figured out what was in the list, being in a unique position to do it because they had the data. So they recreate the list, and it's full of all these people. It's like Consortium Ender Joe Loria. There are all these small, low-influence Trump accounts with names like Classy Girl for DJ Key, Trump Dyke is another one. There's lots and lots of people. And I reached out to, you know, probably a couple of dozen of them, talked to a bunch of them on the phone. They're all over the world, but they're real people. They're not Russian agents. They just had these opinions. And so they were used as sort of fodder to create these fake news stories.
So why did the most prestigious and powerful media organizations, and why did universities such as Harvard, Princeton, MIT, why do you think they so enthusiastically signed on for the witch hunt?
Well, I think this is connected to a bigger picture that I don't fully have yet. I mean, I think there are things that are going to come into view, maybe not necessarily for me, but there are people working on it. And the idea is, I think that this whole concept of Russian disinformation was used as a battering ram to get inside of companies like Twitter and to influence them to open their doors to sort of government efforts to moderate the platforms, right? We don't like the fact that you're not letting us censor this or that. We want to have more direct control over things. You're housing Russian disinformation activities online. They all got dragged to the Senate floor and the House floor in late 2017, if you remember that. Started with Senator Warner, Mark Warner of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. It spread to all, like the House committees, House Intelligence Committee, and there was Energy and Commerce. It never ended. The companies finally said uncle and let these people in. I think this is all related. These stories were used basically to make the argument that you have to let us start censoring people.
So, as you know, I was overseas for 20 years, and it just smells like these CIA front groups. So CIA, in some countries I was in, actually owned newspapers. But do we know the genesis of it? Do we know how deep these roots go?
So that's a tough question to answer yet. I think we got to look at some of those things. You look at the advisory board of who's on the think tank that birthed this thing. It's chock full of former intelligence officials, Michael Morell, the ex-CIA director. He was going to be Hillary's CIA chief. Mike Chertoff, who was the Homeland Security chief during the Iraq period. There's a former deputy head of the NSA on there. And then Hamilton is also connected to a company called New Knowledge that was an advisor to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. A number of their people were involved in testifying before the Senate and the House.
Twitter was complicit because, as you point out, they did, through this reverse engineering, realize that this was a scam. But they did not make it public and continued to engage in the censorship that was demanded of them. Talk about that. And also, can you talk about Twitter's secret blacklist?
So the first question, yes, Joel Roth was the trust and safety chief at Twitter, who became kind of an infamous figure after the first batch of Twitter files was released because he was sort of influential in suppressing the Hunter Biden story. But he actually pushed back against this. There's a number of quotes from him. He's saying, I think we have to just call this out on the BS it is. That's one of the more explosive quotes from him. He's saying that this dashboard will take ordinary conservatives and accuse them of being Russian. But he was met with a opposition within the company, sort of senior former White House officials who worked in the comms department. We're saying we have to be careful on how we push back. There's a gentleman named Carlos Monnier who went on to work for Pete Buttigieg, who says, I want to push back too, but we have to play the longer game. As you say, Twitter's role is difficult to assess because on the one hand, they didn't play ball with Hamilton 68, but they also didn't make it public either. So I don't know how you call that one. I mean, they are complicit in a way, for sure.
So let's talk about the press formula. I love it when you do these. You have a habit of kind of boiling it right down to the essence. You said, here's the formula for how it worked. Defamation became hardwired into the media landscape. Quote, research institute makes invented bot claims. Reporters toss said claims at hated targets. like Tulsi Gabbard, headlines flow. You said the scam needs just three elements: credential of someone like former FBI agent Watts, the absence of any semblance of fact-checking, and the silence of companies like Twitter. But it was, it worked exactly as you pointed out, and with just no incredulity. I mean, they just swallowed it whole.
Yeah, and that's the part that is hard for me to grasp, because I can understand a couple of reporters getting beat by this, but all of them? I mean, that's difficult to understand. And then there were obviously a few of us that I know you would never fall. Like, you and I talked about this at the time, how ridiculous all these stories were. People like Glenn Greenwald specifically called out this site. I did as well a few times. There was actually, believe it or not, a Tucker Carlson segment about it. But I would say 99% of the working reporters kind of fell for this. And nobody within these institutions to whom this was pitched backed up on it, as far as I know. I haven't found that yet, but there aren't reporters coming out of the woodwork who said, oh, I got pitched by these folks and I didn't do that story, or I exposed them. Because there's only two ways this can go. If somebody pitches you and you find out they're fake, you have an obligation at that point to kind of out it, don't you? I mean, yeah. I would think. So it's remarkable not only that it happened, but also now that we know what they did, that nobody's backing up.
Well, your fundamental job as a reporter is to determine whether it's fake or not. That's what being a reporter means. But there was zero effort.
Right. And that's what's so amazing. Again, you know, you think about what you did for a living, what I've done for so long. You think about what somebody like Jeff Gerst did for, you know, years before this Columbia Journalism Review piece that came out this week. Your phone call after phone call, right, to ascertain what happened. And during this period, you had these incredible pieces where somebody at a magazine like Mother Jones would say, here's what Russian bots are pushing today. And they would just look at the dashboard and then just start writing. There's no middle part to this where you make a phone call, right? So they basically automated the sourcing process for these folks, and it was phony. So I think it's a dangerous thing. And the problem with this is that while this was a pretty simple, cartoonish almost scam, there are lots of more sophisticated ones out there that will be harder to unravel.
I mean, David Korn at Mother Jones has dined out on this for 5 years. And I think you mentioned before, he's written some kind of a response to Jeff Gerst. What did he say?
The Columbia Journalism Review's 24,000 word piece is a big fail. And, you know, again, at first, I kind of sympathized. I knew David a little bit. And, you know, in this business, it happens. Like, sometimes sources lie to you and you screw up. Like, you fall for something. It does happen. It shouldn't, right? I mean, it's not like being a doctor where if you screw up, somebody dies necessarily. But sometimes mistakes happen and you get a source like Christopher Steele, who comes to you and he's got all these credentialed people vouching for him, right? You can see how that can happen. But you got to own it when that happens. You can't turn around and attack people for describing how that was wrong. I was very upset by Mother Jones' response to this whole thing. These organizations need to reestablish their credibility. And Gerst, who worked, you know, at your paper, Bob Woodward now is saying that they, you know, these companies need to look themselves in the mirror, and they won't do it. Curious to hear your thoughts about why.
I mean, I think it goes back to your book, Hate Inc. First, tell us what the response has been. I mean, it's been this deafening silence.
Nothing. Again, started out as a 26,000 word piece. If a story, a book length investigation in the Columbia Journalism Review doesn't get you 30 seconds on CNN, then I don't know what will, you know, what would prompt a response at this point.
Well, but what about the data? I mean, you have printed the data and there's no response.
Well, it's worse than that. They've actively said the opposite. I mean, not that I mind, I'm used to it at this point, but there have been lots of stories about how what an awful person I am and what an awful person Elon Musk is.
I mean, it's irrelevant. I mean, nobody's ever accused Cy Hirsch of being warm and fuzzy. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just silly. I'm joking, of course. I like you very much, but it just has nothing to do with the topic.
Yeah, it's a total. It's a you know, to use a journalism cliche, it's a non-denial denial, right?
Like
you're not addressing the issue. There was an amazing line in the Mother Jones piece about the CGR thing where they said, they're saying, Girth is arguing that the collision didn't happen, but in a sense, it did happen, right? Which is, I don't know, that's exactly what we're trained to assess. Did it happen really or in a sense, right? Like, if it's just in a sense, we can't print it. Like, that's the entire purpose of a newspaper.
What you're watching is the complete moral bankruptcy in real time of the press, which, and I'll go to your book, Hate Inc., because I think you made an important point, where media organizations, unlike the old model, have now siloed themselves to cater to a particular demographic. And when you're catering to that demographic, what you're in essence doing is feeding that demographic what it wants to hear. And we had mentioned the other day when we spoke about the Caliphate podcast at the New York Times, which was based on one source that was completely fraudulent. And I had been in the Middle East 7 years. I remember listening to just the first 10 minutes, and it had this kind of snuff porn quality to it, people being crucified on crosses and stuff. And it just stank of fiction, I mean, having come out of the Middle East. And there's no accountability. I mean, the reporter, it wasn't fired because they fed their demographic what they wanted to hear. And I think that has eroded accountability because it all becomes about stroking the demographic as a commercial model. I'm just summing up, you know, the points you made in your book.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Once upon a time, right? I mean, not to be all back in the day about it, but if you printed something like Caliphate, if you did a story like that and put your whole weight into it and it was completely fake and you did no work to see whether it happened, it was a career-ending thing. It could be a career-ending thing. Right.
Yeah.
And that hung over every reporter's head. That was the defense mechanism of the business. That's gone. There is no sort of Damocles over your head now when you work. If you make a mistake, it's accepted. It's understood because this is an entertainment product now. It's not a service, and you're not trying to determine the truth. It's not like an evidentiary process. I don't know how to think about it, honestly.
Well, and if you report, as you have done, in such a way that discredits or critiques or undermines that narrative, then I think you and Glenn have become examples of this. You are very viciously attacked. I don't follow it closely, but I think they've now calling you some kind of closet right winger. I don't know what they're calling you, but that becomes a response.
Yeah, that's the go-to response now. The Washington Post amusingly actually described me as conservative journalist in one of their pieces. And before I even heard about it, there was such an uproar online that they sort of silent edited it out of the piece.
Isn't this the Washington Post that won the Pulitzer for the Russiagate material that they then took down off their website? Is that the same?
That's the same Washington Post that ran a sort of a house editorial this week talking about how objectivity is dead. And I was no fan of objectivity necessarily as a model, but as an aspiration, absolutely. That was what the business was all about. We're trying to just ascertain what's true or not. Like, that's kind of the basic function of what we do. And, you know, they're moving into something, some other world now. And it's very sad to watch.
Well, that's why they're crucifying Julian Assange. Democrats loved him with the Iraq-Afghan war logs. And then he had the honesty to print the Podesta emails. If you have them and don't make them public, you can do that as a choice, but you can't then call yourself a journalist. So I find the state, I mean, it's, and I've been in the business a long time, it's extremely depressing. I want to, before we close, bring up, so we saw the Biden administration attempt to appoint this woman, Nina Yanukovych, as the disinformation czar. Now, she's been at the forefront of Russian disinformation. She calls Julian Assange scum. So they tried to set this up in the Homeland Security. It was kind of too much, too unpalatable to establish at this moment a ministry of truth in the United States. Is that where we're headed?
I think that was the idea. Whether we're going to get there or not is an open question. I mean, I think some of the companies don't want to go along. That's the subtext, actually, of the whole Trump years, is that the government wanted increasing amounts of control over these platforms. some of the platforms, sometimes for reasons because they were greedy and they wanted to keep some certain foreign markets open, pushed back. And now there's been this increasingly sort of intense cry for access by agencies like the DHS, which was what Nina Jankowicz was going to be. It was going to be under Homeland Security. Well, they did still go through with something like that. They just didn't create the open board. Lee Fong did a report in The Intercept outing how that works. We've seen sort of echoes of it in the Twitter files. We do see how requests for content moderation are routed through the FBI and DHS specifically. There's a bureaucracy that's been set up. So that's what they want. Whether they're going to get it absolutely or how much they've gotten it is kind of an open question. As you see that some of the companies are breaking ranks openly, and that's what this argument's about.
Well, aren't they getting it through subterfuge, in essence?
Yeah, no, they're creating a panic around something. And look, yes, these things all do exist. Like there are foreign information operations that do exist. Russia has one. They based it on ours, but they do have one. They do these things. They do create social media accounts. They do try to introduce themes into our conversations. And there are domestic extremists in America. As you know, there are lunatics on all sides, but there are, of course, racists and crazies and people who make threats. It's a difficult question, though, how to deal with that. But they amplified these problems in order to get access. They said, these problems are emergencies. We must get in. You must let us have control. And they lied about the scale of it.
Well, the difference is this isn't against extremism. It is about protecting a neoliberal order, which has visited tremendous suffering on the American people that they have no intention of changing. In fact, they will accelerate it. And so it becomes, in essence, finding a scapegoat. I mean, the reason Trump wins the elections and not because the white working class has been impoverished and dethroned, but because of Russia. That was Matt Taibbi. You can read his article, which you should read, on his Substack on Hamilton 68. I want to thank the Real News Network. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
You heard the Chris Hedges interview of Matt Taibbi on Hamilton 68. Recorded on February 10, 2023. Matt Taibbi is an author, journalist, and podcaster. He's publisher of the newsletter Racket on Substack. Chris Hedges is a journalist, Presbyterian minister, author, and commentator. He reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005. In April 2022, he began podcasting The Chris Hedges Report on TRNN, the Real News Network. Please look up the Zoom recording and transcript of this conversation on The Chris Hedges Report on TRNN. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.